Bob Nelms, who performed and wrote Bobby's Bossa Nova, and that's on his recording Pretty Music on India Navigation Records. Bob Nelms is a jazz pianist based in New York, and he's just beginning to gain a wider reputation for himself, as demonstrated by the release of his first solo recording. He has also recorded with Charles Mingus and Hamiet Bluett, and has worked with Eric Dolphy, Roy Haynes, and Sonny Murray. And he was in Philadelphia last month to perform in a solo concert for the Alternative Concert Series, and that concert took place at Haverford College. When he was in town, Nelms came to our studios to tape an interview, and we spoke about an earlier part of his career, about his work in the 1960s as the house pianist for Motown Records, the soul music label which was started by Berry Gordy Jr. in Detroit. While with Motown, he recorded and toured with groups like the Supremes, Martha and the Vandellas, Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, and Mary Wells. His playing can be heard on hits like Dancing in the Street, You've Really Got a Hold on Me, Baby Love, and Heatwave, and he told me about his early involvement with Motown.
I was in Detroit, and I think I was about 18 years old, and a saxophone player told me there was an opening in a big band, Choker Camel's big band, and I should go to this particular hotel and look up Choker Camel, which I did, and then I joined his band, and we played for major acts, backing major acts like Aretha Franklin, George Kirby, and so forth and so on. And then Motown got started, and I think Berry Gordy was looking for a studio band, and he hired the whole band intact. So that's how we got into Motown.
So when you walked into the studio, these were with players that you already knew.
Right.
How would you describe the backgrounds of the people that were playing on these sessions?
Okay, the band, the instrumentalists, for the most part, in the orchestra, had a jazz background. They were mostly jazz musicians. We were adapting ourselves to the Motown sound. The guitar players, a lot of guitar players were strictly, I would say, rhythm and blues guitar players. And then you had the rhythm section. We were proud of the rhythm section because we had the famous James Jamerson on bass, and he was just a one of a kind of a person. And then the main instrument in the Motown sound was the drummer. The drummer. He had to have excellent drummer.
How long did it take for that sound to evolve once you started working in the studio?
That's the thing. It was the magic. It just was there already. It's the combination of people were just came together and it was there.
Well, one of the groups you played with was Martha Reeves and the Vandellas,
right.
And like to play Heatwave, which was recorded in July of 1963. Do you remember that session at all when you did that?
No. No, we used to do so many sessions. It was like going to work in the factory and making auto parts. We'd come in and we'd play, and sometimes we wouldn't even know the names of the tunes. We'd just play.
Pianist Bob Nelms talking about his early days, and one of the groups he did play with was Martha and the Vandellas. We're going to hear that right now, a cut of Heatwave, and this is from a box set called The Motown Story, and each cut on this record is introduced by one of the artists. So this will be introduced by Martha Reeves.
It was when I think the Charleston sound was trying to be revised. It has a beat similar to the Charleston, which is also similar to Quicksand. We got in kind of the same kind of a groove with those two particular records. The thrilling thing about Heatwave was the fact that while it was number 10 across the nation, I think, there was a heat wave in Los Angeles, and they used it as a news spot.
Starts to burn.
Well, that was Heat Wave by Martha Reeves and the Vandellas, recorded in 1963. How long has it been since you've heard that, Bob?
1963.
Uh-huh.
Right.
No. Do you have much of a recollection now that you listen back as to what the sessions were like? I mean, what time you'd arrive, if you, what they would hand you by way of the music, or how it would be to get the tune together?
In a general sense, I do. Because I was so young at the time, I didn't place that much importance on it. But I remember we would, they'd say, come to the studio at 10 o'clock, and we'd walk in, and they would pass out the music. And some days we would come in, and we would maybe record one song. Some days we'd come in, and we might record 10 songs. You know, we were on salary. The musicians were on salary. We got paid the same regardless of how many songs we recorded. You know, so it was like a steady job. It was a good job.
Well, when you were given an arrangement, was everything written out? Were the breaks written out and that type of thing, or what were you given?
Yeah, they were, for the most part, I'd say 90% of the time, they were written out. On the solo, on some of the instrumental solos, you know, we could do pretty much what we wanted. But Barry sort of wanted, he kept a tight rein and on what he wanted, you know, so we couldn't take it too far out, you know. But it reminds me of a good story. I can remember my very first session at Motown, the very first day, and I had just come out of years and years of studying in conservatory, and I had this awesome technique. And we came in the studio, and the first music they handed me, I forgot what the tune was, and my parts, I was supposed to go on the piano, ding, 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 ding. So I was sort of proud of my technique, so I thought to myself, I said, what'll really be great is if, rather than go ding, 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 I'll play something so awe-inspiring, right? So technically surprising that they'll come rushing out of the studio and say, wow, we've discovered this genius. So they say, okay, take one, right? So rather than go ding, 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 like I was supposed to go, I went, and the producer at the time was a guy, he was 19 years old. And I can't remember his name. And he came running out of the control booth talking about, stop it, stop it, stop it, stop it, you fool. And he said, you're doing it all wrong. You know, what are you doing? And I remember I said something to him like, who are you who are from the streets to tell me, who has had all this education, this training, you know, what to do? So what he did, he played it. He said, listen to the tape back. It's very nice advice. You know, I sound like a bull in a china shop. And that producer, by the way, was the first time I had seen a man. He was so good at his job. He made so much money. It was the first time I'd seen a man that had money sticking out of his pockets, you know, literally sticking out of his pockets. So.
What would Berry Gordy do when he would show up at a session to give you some direction and let you know what he wanted for the Motown sound?
Berry, only time I remember Berry was passing him in the offices. You know, he might stick his head in. He was very, stayed in the background very quietly. He reminds me of Alfred, the way Alfred Hitchcock would work. He seemed like he had everything planned ahead of time. So by the time whatever project we were working on would already be fixed, you know, in his mind, and he would he was a great delegator of authority, you know, so he was pretty much in the background, although he was the main catalyst for everything.
How was he thought of? I mean, was he the leader or the slave driver, or how did people regard him?
Well, of course, that depends on who you talked to. By and large, everybody thought that the man was a genius, because remember, he put all these components together. That was him, you know. And of course, they had you had your jealousies when Diana Ross started coming to the fore, you know, and some of the other acts had less importance put on them, you know. But by and large, Barry was thought of very, very well, very, very nice man.
Did you get the sense that you were told what to play, or did you figure you could pretty much take a chart, do with it what you wanted, and then see what the producer would say?
No. After that first time, I realized that you better play what they put down there.
So it would actually be written out for you?
Yeah.
I read a story about how Lamont Dozier, who was one of the songwriters and producers at Motown, mm-hmm. I guess he wrote a lot of Temptations and Supremes and
right.
lots of hits for a lot of people. Mm. He would strike the underside of a piano with a hammer when the pianist was playing the chords, and he'd say that, you know, you'd really hear the chord with a whack. But did that ever happen?
Not that I recall, but it's not surprising that you had an information, because there were a lot of little gimmicks that were on the studio that went on in the studio that I could safely now, since it's been, what, 20, almost 25 years, maybe bring out, you know. One thing, if anybody from Motown's listening, I'm hoping not giving out any trade secrets, but one thing, we always used to have a bongo drum. A lot of times you couldn't hear it. A lot of those records, hundreds of those records, you could not hear the bongo drum, but there would be a bongo drum in the background, you know? And it just gave it a little certain flavor to the music, because if you notice, most of this music is, not most of it, but a lot of it has a sort of a shuffle feeling, you know? And some of the other things, I know the placement of the singers and the placement of the musicians, I know, is very important. I think Barry had a lot to do with that, because he found that particular building where we recorded, and so he knew every nuance of the acoustical properties of it, so he knew exactly where everybody should be. And one great thing about it was we recorded, everybody together with no earphones, no nothing, you know. It was beautiful. Yeah.
Well, there's always a lot of, on most of the hits, especially Martha Reeves and the Vandals, is a real good example. Mm-hmm. You usually hear a tambourine, clapping. Sometimes there's some yelling in the background, yeah, or some whatever. Was that stuff planned out, or was that pretty much spontaneously come out and then worked with in the production?
Now, there you go. Some of that was improvised. You know, you say, okay, we want to have a tambourine here, or maybe you can start clapping your hands in this fourth chorus. But a lot of that little extra background thing was sort of improvised. That was the feeling, you know, because it was just like, practically everybody that recorded were friends, you know. They all grew up in the same town, and so they could more or less read one another's feelings and minds and make that music happen, you know, spontaneously like that.
What was the atmosphere like? Was it a party or was it business?
Both. Both. When you got to the studio, it was business. I mean, nobody fooled around, because we all respected each other, and we respected what Barry was trying to do at the time. And because remember, he started from scratch, from you know, he wasn't like CBS, which was already, or RCA, which was already established. This was a new guy starting out, you know. It was business, but it was loose, you know. It was loose. Now, there was this, if I remember correctly, it seemed like the criteria for getting into Motown was that it was best if you were related to somebody, through whether you could be a fifth cousin, you know, or a fourth uncle or something. And I think the theory behind that was that it would cut out a lot of backstabbing and, you know, just rankism. You know, that would be totally unnecessary. No, the feeling was very good.
Yeah. Were there many white players in the band or in the studio musicians?
Not in the original days. There were some, and they were Detroiters, right? And the matter of race didn't come up. It was just that they could play. And what happened is that I think they came in because they probably played. It was either played certain instruments, or they had a certain feel that somebody else didn't have, so they were brought in. And then I can remember in the end of 62, 63, when we started doing strings, they used to hire the Detroit Symphony or somebody. And then when the company started really getting big, and then you started having a great mix of people coming in.
Uh-huh. I always had the image that when strings first came into Motown recordings, that you probably had two very different sets of people. You had the performers, let's say like the Supremes, mm-hmm, and the band, the Motown band, and then all these other guys from the orchestra who really probably could do a very proficient job at reading the music and so forth, but really didn't have much of an idea of what the overall sound would be like. Did you feel that difference?
Well, if I remember, I never saw or participated in string recording, because usually we were on the road a lot, and what we would do, we'd go in the studio and make the tracks, say we go in the studio for 2 weeks, and then we go back out on the road. You know, so in the meantime, while we're on the road, the record is being mixed and edited and so forth. And I think that they would take That was the only time they would start overdubbing, to take the Detroit, I think it was Detroit, some of the strings from the Detroit Symphony, and they would maybe go to another studio and, you know, dub the strings in. Who did that? Who started the string? Was it the Supremes? You remember?
I don't know. I know the Supremes started to really, and also the Supremes started having like electronic effects on the records and stuff like that.
You know, speaking of Supremes, I remember on the, we used to travel on the band bus, right, and on the road, and the major, some of your top acts like Marvin Gaye and the Miracles, they had their own limousines and their own drivers, chauffeurs. But I remember the Supremes were 15 years old, 16 years old, and we were all on the bus together with the orchestra. I remember there were 49 people in the bus driver on this Greyhound bus, and the Supremes had their mother was a chaperone, and the band was, if you recall me saying, was composed mostly of jazz players, right? You know, we used to get, you know, you get bugged out after a few weeks of playing ting 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 ting, or doom boom ba doom boom boom, right? So one time to kill time, we took a vote on which group we thought 20 years from now would be the big group of the day. And we liked Martha the Vandellas because we thought of all the singing groups that they swung the most and that they had, you know, the best musicianship. And I remember that we voted the Supremes would never, we said the band said the Supremes would never never make it, which shows you what we knew.
Right? Well, you were right about the swing in Martha and the Vandellas. Mm-hmm. Let's hear some more Martha and the Vandellas. This is not quite 20 years old, recorded in July of 1964, Dancing in the Streets. Any recollections of this session, or is this just one in a number of sessions?
It was just one in a number. Just one in a number.
Well, let's hear it. Well, that was from 1964, Martha and the Vandellas, Dancing in the Streets. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Bob Nellums, who is a jazz player. He's played in the past with Eric Dolphy, Charles Mingus, and in the early 60s was the house pianist with Motown and played with people like Smokey Robinson, Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder, and Martha and the Vandellas. Bob, did you know that what we just heard, for instance, did you know that would be a hit when you recorded it?
No. No. No, we knew that the music was We knew that the music was on the charts, was getting on the charts. I mean, not only because it was good, but because, you know, certain business moves, you know, that gets music on the chart. In those days, remember, those were the days of the Dick Clark, don't let me say it, let it all out, but, you know, the American Bandstand mm-hmm. and so forth, chartbreakers. But we knew. It was funny, when we go on the road, we stop at go to a coffee shop or something, and we hear something on the radio, and we say, that sounds familiar. It would be something we made 3 weeks ago, you know. So we didn't pay that much attention to it. I'll tell you who we did pay attention to when we recorded or when we played for them was the Miracles, Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, and I'll tell you why. Some of the groups, when we played, not in the studio, we gave full attention to them in the studio, but on the road when we played the show, some of the groups, we said, okay, here comes so-and-so. So the band will play la da 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 da. You know, we give our professional best, but when Smokey and Robinson and the Miracles would come out, the band would sit up and make sure we were in tune and everything, and I'll tell you why. Because every 2 weeks, Smokey and the Miracles would give everybody in the band a bottle of champagne. That was our favorite group. Smokey's smart, you know.
Smokey produced a lot of the records that you played on. How was he as a producer? Would he be very specific about what he wanted?
I don't recall Smokey as a producer, his activities as a producer. I know he was a major domo in that, in the production end of it. And the reason I don't recall, because as a musician, I just come in and they give me the music and I play it. So, it's funny, everybody was so friendly, we never thought each other so much in terms of your designated official duties, you know? It was just,
Jazz pianist Bob Nelums, who started his career as a house pianist for Motown Records. Well, let's see how well the band played for Smokey Robinson, and listen to You've Really Got a Hold on Me, which was recorded by Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, and that'll be followed by Marvin Gaye's recording of Pride and Joy, with my guest Bob Nelums on piano, and these recordings are from The Motown Story, a recorded history of Motown.
In 1962, Smokey Robinson was becoming Motown's most prolific writer of hit songs, mostly about love.
I don't know. I guess my mind is just oriented towards that type of thought, or sad songs dealing with love. I think more people identify with these type of songs. You can start singing a happy song and it strikes a groove, you know, it'll strike a groove and people get happy and everything, but the sad songs get the reaction.
Really?
Then, in 1963, Marvin Gaye wrote his own hit.
I don't know what ever prompted me to write a song entitled Pride and Joy. I imagine my wife had something to do with it. I was very much in love, I think, at that time with my wife. And that's why I wrote it, I think. And when I recorded it, I was thinking of it very much.
This is sort of a silly question, but it's one I've always wondered about. How did you end a tune when you were playing in the studio?
Mm-hmm.
How did you end a tune that fades out on the records? I mean, do you just play the end over and over again until they figure they got enough to fade out on, or what? How did you?
That's exactly how we did it, right? And the engineer would fade it down. The engineer would down the street, then we play that for 30 times, and you know, then it would fade it in the studio. You know, now on the, of course, we couldn't do that in live shows. See, we couldn't do it on live shows. So it'd be dancing in the street, la da da da, and the dancing in the street. We play that about 20 times, and somebody would give a signal, and we cut. And I'll never forget that every tune was like, you know, one last B chord, da. Right. Yeah.
Did you do many TV appearances with the band?
No. That was after I left when the act started getting on television and so forth. Every now and then I see some old nostalgic shows on TV and I look for myself, but I think I just missed out on that end.
I've always wondered what type of coaching people got for lip syncing and how the band plays when they're really playing the record, but the band's playing to the syncing.
Now, I don't know about the band. I'll tell you this. I know that the acts were really coached a lot. They had Charlie Akins did the choreography. Right, and I saw the Temptations on television the other day, and it still amazes me how people can sing so well and do those intricate steps, you know, that they do. Everybody in Motown was coached to a T, I'd have to say. They coached how to act, how to walk, what to say in interviews. In fact, a lot of those interviews were not from the words of the artists themselves. That was from the studio, and there was a good reason for that, because they wanted to project a certain image and make sure that nothing went wrong. In fact, I remember I learned years later after I left Motown that my mother was who lives in Detroit now was a etiquette coach for the Supremes when the Supremes started playing Vegas, and the Copacabana and so forth. And I remember speaking of coaching. I remember I was living in San Jose, California, in the mid '60s. So I saw in the paper that Marvin Gaye was coming to town. Ah, so I said, "Well, I'll go hear Marvin Gaye. I haven't seen Marvin for long. No, I think it was in the late '60s. Right? I haven't seen Marvin for years. So walked in this club, and Marvin, they were grooming Marvin to go into Vegas and the Copacabana. And if you hear this, Marvin, excuse me, but I got to tell people this. And I walked in, you know, here was the man I knew who had made Stubborn Kind of Fella and Hitchhike Baby, and he was singing, I've got my, what is it, the Fred Astaire tune, my top hat and tails, right? And he had a cane, he was doing a little soft shoe, and he's walking through the audience, kissing ladies, you know, like an a morning television show. So I went to his, and he had this, he had the local orchestra that was drawn from the musicians union in San Jose, and they all looked like they were about 90 years plus, you know, and there was no spirit in the show whatsoever. And Marvin only had one of his musicians and his director with him, and the music just did not have that sound. I went to the dressing room after the show. I said, Marvin, again, I don't know if you remember me. Marvin jumped up and grabbed me by the lapels and dropped to his knees and said, please, can you give me a rhythm section, please?
What type of polishing would they have to do for personal appearances? Because I guess a lot of the performers were sort of home people, you know, mm-hmm. from Detroit and had never really gone to clubs or hit the type of high life that...
Well, they had professional people that work with them, you know. They had professional people that showed them how, taught them how to dress and, you know.
I read that there were classes every evening that the performers had to go to. There were compulsory classes in that exactly that time.
I read that later after I left. I wasn't aware of it at the time I was there. But sure, I can see that, yeah.
What type of touring did you do with people, and what was the touring like?
Oh, the touring. I remember that was my first, Motown was my first major tour. And I think it was 1962, 1961. We used to take the whole show on the road at once.
A review.
The Motown review, mm-hmm. right, from all those albums, right? And I like to find some of those albums, too. Anyway, we used to take the whole town. And the first tour we had was in the Deep South. I mean the Deep South. Deep, Deep South. And it was during the time, you know, of Martin Luther King, just before he was assassinated. And so things weren't too calm down there at the time. And I can remember, and it was a big thing because here's this local boy, Berry Gordy, making good, and he's going to test the waters, the national waters with this tour. And the day we left, all people's parents came out, and their uncles, and banners, and everybody had packages of cookies and fried chicken they're giving them for the trip, and a big banner over Motown building, good luck, artist. And we got all in the buses and the cars, and Berry Gordy, I'll never forget this, Berry Gordy stood on the stoop, and he said, remember this, you're going down to entertain, not to integrate, right? And that was his thing. He said, don't raise any, don't make any waves, you know, which was not always possible. Was not possible because we were shot at. You know, I remember a bullet came to the bus in one town and it just barely missed Mary Wells by a couple of inches. We were, you know, because we tried to eat at a local Greyhound bus terminal in those days, which was federally integrated, you know, integrated by federal law. And some people didn't, some of the localites didn't like that. And I remember. I think it was Mobile, Alabama. We were on a double bill with the Motown Review with the pianist Roger Williams of Autumn Leaves fame. Right, can you imagine that? Right. So he came on first, and all the white people sat downstairs, and all the black folks sat upstairs. And then when we came on, everybody switched. You know, that, I cracked up. And then I also remember down in, I think somewhere in South Carolina, North Carolina, they had a rope down the middle, separating the kids, right? Because the white kids and the African-American kids were not supposed to mingle. Well, I can never forget this. When the music got going, the kids started grabbing each other over the rope and started dancing with each other, right, in this auditorium. And the cops were trying to break them up. And the music overpowered the police action, which I thought was just a beautiful statement for humanity, you know? So.
Did you have to stay in specific hotels that would allow black people?
Yes, we did. However, like I say, Barry said, you're going out there not to integrate but to entertain. But there were some times, I mean, we got to Louisville, Kentucky. And for some reason or other, we had to stay, I think it was in one of the major hotels, Sheraton or Statler or something like that. And no black people ever stayed there before. And we were there. And I remember we were there at the same time that a convention of Southern teachers was booked there. And I remember my roommate, it was a trumpet player named Herbie Jones. And Herbie and I, at one time, we decided to see how it was to be rich. And so I think we got the bridal suite. And we heard this ruckus outside the door. And we opened the door, and there were these teachers looking under, trying to look underneath the door to see how we lived, you know. So dangerous, but at that age, at my young age, you know, it was sort of fun. Of course, then, too, I had the extra job. I was driving the choker. I got the job of driving the bandleader's car. He had, in those days, a big Mark IV Continental. And I think the shortest hop we had, and we were doing one-nighters, was like 400 miles. So every night we play, pack up and drive, you know. And Choker Campbell had a reputation, beautiful guy, he had a reputation of never being late on a musical job in 25 years, right? So that meant if we had to drive 500 miles, I mean, I had to go speeds 125 miles an hour. Choker knew every back road. He knew every trick to circumvent the state troopers. I'll never do that again. That's how I started drinking.
Were there white players on the trips with you, or were these tours?
This first tour, there were none on this first tour. No, we had a white bus driver.
And would he stay in the same hotels?
I don't remember. I don't remember. Because a lot of times we wouldn't stay in, we didn't have a chance to stay in hotels because the jumps were so long. We would just play, get on the bus, drive, get out, play. I mean, you know.
Yeah. How did the people in the musicians and the performers feel about being instructed to stay away from politics? Was there much discussion amongst you about how you saw yourselves in relation to Martin Luther King or Malcolm X or the ideas of black power and so on?
Oh, sure. I'm sure everybody had their own particular political views about that. I don't recall any specific discussions, but I know that we probably brought it up, you know, because I was pretty political at the time. I was emotional about things. But everybody put everything aside for the sake of getting Motown off the ground, you know. And if Barry told us to be cool, that's what we did, you know.
Let's listen to another record, one that you recorded with Marvin Gaye, Ain't That Peculiar. Do you remember anything about this session?
About that session? I vaguely remember making that. There's a couple of tracks that I recorded that I figured they stayed with me. One was You Really Got a Hold on Me. I think this is one I sort of remember. One, before you play the record, one thing. Marvin Gaye asked me, while we were on that first road trip, a couple of times he called me in his motel rooms or hotel room, and he would say, listen, I'm going to need a musical director. How about it? And I say, Marvin, no, because you're just going to be a rock and roll singer for the rest of your life. Shows you what I knew, right?
Okay. Well, you lost out on that
yes!
one, Bob. Okay, well, this is from 1965. Marvin Gaye, Ain't That Peculiar.
Flowers grow from rain, but how can love grow from pain?
From 1965, that was Marvin Gaye singing Ain't That Peculiar, and that was with my guest, Bob Nelens.
You can send $9.95 and get the entire collection.
Okay, I guess that's where you might be reminded of the old Motown releases, because they're on TV ads a lot.
Yeah, all the time, right. Boy, I could retire if I could got a penny for every one they sold, I guess.
Well, what was the money like, and how much of that do you see now?
Oh, what do I see? I don't see anything. No, we got our money, and that was it, you know. Of course, in those days, we didn't have the awareness that we do now, and anticipating future profits, and that's all I care to say about that subject, I think.
Are there many? Do you think that's something that was shared amongst other players at Motown?
What's that?
That general sense of I'd rather not talk about it because it didn't end too well as far as the money went.
Well, I won't say it didn't end too well, because at the time we did pretty good, but. I don't want to say anything that might get someone in, you know, trouble, you know.
Well, there's one thing I did want to ask you about the tune we just heard, which was your playing on it was it really swung like a jazz player in terms of just the chords you were hitting, and it wasn't the ting 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 that you were talking about before, but there was a real rhythm to it. What was going through your mind in terms of what you were trying to do when you're playing when you played that?
After hearing that track, I recall after all these years. What happened? So I remember that particular arrangement. They gave me a lead line and a rhythm, a particular rhythm to play, but I had to put my own voicings, if I'm not mistaken, with that. So I'd listen to the band and mesh in with that. So a lot of these voicings were my what I heard in my head, you know, based upon what I was instructed to play. So I'm pretty proud of that. I think it was a contribution to the sound. Yeah.
When there would be retakes of tunes, would you play differently?
If I was told, yeah. If I was told that what I played previously, you know, isn't quite what they wanted, I'd try to change it, you know, a little bit to what they wanted. But I wouldn't. It's funny when you're younger, you don't intellectualize that much about it. It's sort of like Mingus. When I joined Mingus. I joined that band with no rehearsal. I played at, Binghamton College, I think. And first time I even met the man. We hit the concert stage. And he always claimed that I played better at that time than even 3 years later when I used to think too much about the music. So I didn't really, it came more or less naturally, you know, for me.
Well, when somebody would say, change this, Bob, were you pretty open-minded about it, or did you figure you had the better idea, but you'll do it anyway because it was the gig?
Oh, I'm sure there were times when I thought that I knew better, I knew best, you know, but because I had a little cockiness in me in those days. So it was give and take, you know, I'd grumble sometimes, but if it was somebody I respected, I'd change it. But a lot of the producers who I knew that just, they knew the music off of the streets would, I'd have a hard time accepting what they say. Which, speaking of off the street, I remember sometimes Barry Gordy would, the school kids would file past Motown, the junior high school and high school kids would file past Motown every afternoon after they got off school. And a lot of them would have little groups and they'd walk singing these little things they made up. And I remember quite often Barry Gordy would sit on the stoop and just, you know, cock an ear. To these people. So,
how would Gordy decide what to release? Because I wouldn't
know. That's beyond my knowledge. That was behind the corporate doors. You know.
Were you very surprised when you'd hear a record after the session? You know, when 3-4 weeks later you hear it and how it would sound like?
Sure, yeah. Because like I say, a lot of times, say for example, like what we just heard. Ain't That Peculiar? Now that's a very definite musical statement. But some of the tunes which we didn't pay much attention to, you wouldn't even recall recording them. And so when you did hear them, it would, you know, be a big surprise, right?
Do you know what was done in the time between the session and when the record came out, as far as like the mixing or the overdubbing and stuff like that?
No, and that was kept. That was a highly guarded secret. You know, that was, you know, like, so I'm thinking just some of the things I'm telling you now is just the tip of the iceberg, as far as their production techniques were concerned. No, they had their own particular way of cooking the soup.
Mm-hmm. And that was pretty closely held, huh?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Bob Nellums, who in the early 60s was a studio pianist with Motown, and he played with many people, including Marvin Gaye, Martha and the Vandellas, Stevie Wonder, Smokey Robinson. Who else?
Mary Wells, Marv Johnson, who else? Everybody except the Temptations and Junior Walker, as far as I can remember, you know. I just assume I can't.
Well, let's jump ahead to a very different musical context for what you were doing, which is playing with Charles Mingus.
Before you go ahead, just for a second, I want to say something. There was a very famous record by Stevie Wonder. His first hit, it was called Fingertips. And if I remember right, we recorded that live at the Apollo Theater, right? And I had told you before that I had been driving the bandleader's car, right? And by the time we got to that was our last job on the tour, I think. And by the time we got to that job, I think it was in the winter, I was a nervous wreck. And there was a part in there where the piano makes a gliss, right? Very famous gliss. And I think years, ever since then, piano player's been glistening. Anyhow, I wasn't supposed to play that gliss. I was supposed to play something else. But I was so tired, I forgot what I was supposed to play. So I said, well, I got to fill it up. So I glissed. So when you hear that, that's how I came in. Okay, get that out.
Pianist Bob Nellums. In a moment, he'll remember some of his time with composer and bassist Charles Mingus. Now let's listen to that glissando Nellums just described on this live Stevie Wonder recording of Fingertips. Stevie Wonder with my guest Bob Nellums on piano. In the early 1970s, Bob moved to New York, where he played with Roy Haynes, Sonny Murray, and Charles Mingus. I asked him how he got involved with Mingus.
A friend of mine, Ricky Ford, who I knew in Boston when I was going to college up there in the 70s, when I went back to school, he had joined Mingus, and there was an opening in the Mingus band, and he called me up and told me there might be an opening, and if I wanted to, I could come down and audition, you know. So I thought that was great. So I got out all my old Mingus records. I've been a fan of his since I was very young, and I got all my old Mingus records and his tunes, so that no matter what he called, I'd be ready. So he was at the Village Gate in New York, and I came in. I was introduced. He said, okay, come on, kid, and play a tune. We played one blues. It was Blue and Boogie. He said, thank you very much. And I went, and I forgot about it. One thing I didn't think about as an audition, though. If I had done that, I would have been too nervous. I thought about it just as a chance to, like, jamming with this great guy and this great band, you know? And I forgot about it. I really had forgotten about it. And then I enrolled back in school again and forgotten about it. And then on New Year's Eve, 1976, I got a call. Says, come on, join the band. That's how I got in the band.
What type of direction would Mingus give you in a session or on the stand? Were you left to do what you thought was right or best, or did he want things done in a certain way as far as his tunes?
Yeah, to emphasize what he wanted, he'd make you lie on the floor and he'd jump up and down on you. No, sorry about that. He was very specific in his directions. Well, he had the music. He had the music written out. He was specific in the direction and how he wanted the melody and the arrangement to be played. He didn't particularly give such a hoot how you did on your own improvised by his part, you know. But as far as, like, I remember he, like, on his ballads, a lot of times he'd play, a tune, he might have gone, like, da-da-da-da, da-da-da, something. And I would make these little cocktail fills in the middle, you know, which I thought were very, you know, very ornamental and very pretty. And he used to jump on me and said, nah, don't do that because you're getting in the way of my melody, you know.
Well, did you spend much time with him when you were traveling?
How do you mean that?
I mean, like hanging out before and after gigs and stuff.
Yeah. He was in ill health a lot of times, but when he felt good, we would hang out, and I learned a lot by hanging out with him. In fact, I think it was the third night I was with the band, 34th night, we were in the Southwest somewhere. He says, he used to have before he got sick, he had a gargantuous appetite. I mean, he'd give Orson Welles a run for his money. So he says, hey, Bob, you want to come eat with me? You know, so naturally, having just gotten in the band and wanting to stay in the band, I said, well, whatever he does, I'm going to do. So, yeah, so we went to some famous restaurant, and I sat at the table with him. He said, no, Bob, this is my table. You get your own table. So I sat at the table next to him. And he says, no, you want to have what I have? I said, sure, you know. So he started off with two large bottles of wine, and he ordered two of everything, you know. And three desserts and this and that. And I'm trying to keep up with him, you know, show him that, well, anything you can do, I can do. And when we finished and we had to go play, I remember I couldn't even play because I was sick. I could barely play. So that was...
Did you talk with him much about stuff? About just other things other than music?
Yeah. Uh-huh. When things came up. He was, you know, he was pretty busy with a lot of projects. So you couldn't just ask him the time of day. In fact, he'd get angry if somebody would just... like I remember we would be traveling all the time, and we would get up in the morning, and one time Ricky Forrest said, good morning, Charles, how are you? And he got mad and said, why do you have to ask me how I am? You just saw me last night, you know, things like that. But he was a wellspring of information. You know, when he felt like it, he would give you know, tell you a lot of things.